Good evening, everyone. I'm very pleased to be here. My name is Evelina Domnic. I'm an artist and I work with Dmitry. We will do a performance of Mucilaginous Omniverse for you in about 1 hour, 45 minutes. But before that, we have a great pleasure to have a conversation with Tomasa Calarco. Tomasa is a theoretical physicist. He is also behind, he's one of the leaders of European Quantum Flagship Project, which is a major research project for lasting for 10 years that European Commission gives 1 billion euros to multiple research groups to work on some very important strategic development in science. And we met Tomasa during a FET project, so something like CERN residencies. So it's art residencies with FET group, Future Emerging Technologies. So FET groups are some of the top research groups in Europe who get serious grants from European Commission to develop various things, from air filters to quantum computers. And during one of these matchmaking meetings, we selected Tomasa's FET project, which he was part of.
RISC, which stands for Rydberg Quantum Simulators. Yes, the segue into our collaboration with Tomasa's group was actually one of the main contenders for a means of quantum computing or quantum simulation, something for which actually its inventor, Wolfgang Pauli, got the Nobel Prize in the early 1980s, something that is known as an ion trap, where charged matter is levitated in very powerful electric fields. More often than not, it is also laser cooled in a high vacuum. And this behavior can be filtered and analyzed in such a way as to not only compute very difficult problems, but also before any kind of computation arises, as Richard Feynman put it, and ushered in not only the age of nanoscience, but also the so-called second quantum revolution, which is now upon us. Richard Feynman said that there's really no way that you can conduct a quantum experiment classically. You have to, in order to enact a quantum experiment, you can only do it by means of another quantum experiment. This information cannot have a classical means of filtration.
So it's quite fantastic today in 2020 to see so many artists interested in science working with scientists and questioning some of the techniques, methods used in science. And when Dmitry and I started in the late 90s in New York City, the situation in the arts wasn't like this. But we were driven, as artists, we'd like to work with human perception, and we'd like to give to human our own perception and that of our viewers these experiences that are on the fringes, that push our senses to the next level. And we were guided by this very counterintuitive ideas from quantum physics. And the first people who were doubting the kind of the outcomes of the first quantum revolution were scientists themselves, people like Einstein, who ridiculed entanglement. He wrote papers on entanglement trying to prove that this idea is ridiculous. So we didn't want to work with objects. We didn't want to objectify reality. We didn't want to work with fixative media, with solid objects. We wanted to present to human senses the world as fields, as something that can be very ephemeral, connected. So that's why we mostly work non-local. That's why we mostly work with light, fluids, fluid dynamics. And in the very beginning, it was quite problematic to us if we could ever be able to give to human experience something that can resemble quantum reality.
And what Evelina just said might seem exoteric. You know, what does it mean, something without objects, reality, objectless reality? What does it mean playing with perceptions? What does it mean going beyond perceptions? And the actually remarkable thing is that what she says is instead extremely accurate from a scientific point of view, because when you go to the bottom of things, reality really does not exist locally. This is really why Einstein ridiculed quantum mechanics. He said it may not possibly make any sense. Because look, this entanglement, these correlations among distant particles. He said this is spooky. It makes no sense. It must be wrong. And this was the only time in which Einstein was wrong himself in his career. And to prove that what he believed to be the case, that quantum mechanics was wrong, he invented the concept of entanglement, which is, you know, taking quantum mechanics to its most extreme consequences. And this is the same foundation which for many, many years was ignored, was considered a purely philosophical aspect, and then is what is now the basis of this technological revolution that we are having, and maybe we'll discuss that a little bit more. But
so you don't know that the previous talk was about CERN, but it was exactly in the after hours of CERN that this has started. Maybe you can.
That is actually a very good point, in the sense that, you know, as I mentioned, this had been considered a philosophy for the good part of 50 years. And then it was a CERN physicist, John Bell, which really in his free time, after hours, started wondering, well, maybe there is something in there. Or rather, this is maybe not just philosophy, it's something which we could make an experiment about. And he conceived an experiment which it took other 25 years to realize. And in this experiment, you can indeed show that reality does not exist locally. And so this is really very connected, so I'm very happy as a physicist to be here in an exhibition which is titled In Search of the Invisible. And invisible has a lot to do with perception, and it has many dimensions. For instance, we all have been taught, and as I learned, also my children are being taught in school, that individual atoms are invisible. You cannot see a single atom, right? This is what we all think, this is what we all were taught, and this is fantastically wrong. In fact, a story that I like to tell about invisibility is that, you know, in my first, I think it was my second week as a postdoc at the University of Innsbruck, where I also met Ralf Dumm here from the European Commission, who was also at the time active there, I took my bike out of the cellar to go home, and in comes a black limousine, and out of the limousine comes the Dalai Lama, who came to Innsbruck to do what was thought to be impossible, to visualize the invisible. So in the lab of my colleague Rainer Blatt, His Holiness, he went to darkness. And it was a structure very, very similar. Actually, it was built by the same person who helped Evelyn and Dimitri build this one, which is actually the main picture on our web portal of our quantum flagship, as you might have seen before. And this structure was this ion trap. And in vacuum, the trap was trapping a single atom. And a laser field would illuminate it. And His Holiness, and you can do that too, went there, and after waiting for a few minutes in darkness, between his eye and the atom, there were only lenses like these glasses, like a microscope. And then you put your eye on the eyepiece, you wait a minute, and you will see it. You see this little tiny, very small greenish thing lighting there in darkness. And this is a single atom, something which was thought to be invisible. And this is really the foundation of this technology, that what was thought to be, you know, crazy, actually the founding fathers of quantum mechanics, they preached, it is ridiculous to imagine that you can experiment with single atoms. This inevitably entails ridiculous consequences. It is like thinking that you can raise a pterodactyl in a zoo. This is the word they used, pterodactyl. Probably it looked very fancy. So, and they were wrong. And for many years, everybody thought, oh, this is impossible. And actually, the ability which such people as my colleague Rainer Blatt and Ferdinand Schmidt-Kahler, who built this thing, and now artists can develop this ability, the possibility to manipulate these individual quantum systems is really the foundation for those quantum technologies. And maybe we can speak more about that for secure communications, for very powerful computing. Google, a few months ago, realized an unprecedented computing power with such quantum systems. But for me, the most exciting thing is still invisibility. And it is something which is much deeper, which really leads into objectlessness, yeah, as our artists here are really embodying in their work. So invisibility means the impossibility to visualize, to perceive, to conceive, yeah, what is the real state of a quantum system. What does it mean? It means that quantum systems are not like normal objects, you know, like this bottle can be here. This is one possible state of this bottle, or it could also be here. That's a different state. But we are never going to find it in both states. It is always either here or there. Quantum systems, like quantum bits, they can be at the same time in two different states. But the point is, I cannot see this. The only thing I can see is I observe them, and they will be here or there. And then one might be tempted to think, okay, while I am not looking, well, the atom exists. It's an object. It possesses properties, regardless of whether I am observing it. And this is wrong. If you think, if you conceive, if you create a mental image of this atom being in a certain state while you are not looking at it, then you are wrong. Then you are implying something which the experiment, which John Bell conceived, disproves. So reality is ultimately invisible. You search for it, you are never going to find it. So this is why I'm very excited to be here tonight.
So I'd like to return a little bit to this idea of objectlessness that comes from, as far as we can see, from Kazimir Malevich in Russia about 100 years ago, which was the same time as the first quantum theory was being born, and of course we feel very. You will see our performance, and you will see it's quite abstract. Is we're never using symbolic language. We never tell stories. We never follow any narrative, because indeed we'd like to invite you to a state of pure resonance with some states of matter that maybe are very difficult to observe, but nonetheless we can find ourselves in their presence, just like we find ourselves in the presence of the world or inside of it. And Kazimir Malevich, we traced some of his history when in 2015 we created two symposia and two exhibitions dedicated to 100 years of the Black Square painting, and we invited contemporary artists who are inspired by ideas of Malevich to do work that can be done today. And tracing his history with the Black Square, so he was doing quite normal figurative painting, quite beautiful, symbolic. And then in 1913, he was doing the scenography for first futuristic opera, Victory Over the Sun.
Futurist opera.
Futurist opera, Victory Over the Sun, with the music by Matyushin, another very important member of Russian avant-garde. And there, for the first time, so Victory Over the Sun, so it's connected to kind of overcoming stars, you know, the death of a star. There was a black square in the scenography of this piece. And then in 1915, he started doing his suprematist paintings, which were basically objects floating in zero gravity. And then within 3 years, he moved, you know, from the suprematist paintings to just doing suprematist paintings, which were white on white. And then he stopped painting altogether and just wrote this theoretical book, The World as Objectlessness. And this works of ion traps that we did together in collaboration with the labs connected to Tomasz's research and working with quantum systems and pushing the second quantum revolution, where you can do experiment and manipulate individual quantum entities. So this ion traps, it is not really, so what you see in a trap is not really an object. What you see there is the movement, the life of electric fields. And if this something that is placed in the electric field does not have a charge, it will never levitate there. So something is inside of a trap only as much as it possesses an electric field or an electric charge. And depending on the quantity of the charge, it will be doing a different dance within its field. And here in this trap, we achieved this square-shaped objects when we saw them.
Square-shaped orbits.
Orbits, I'm sorry.
Well, yeah, and the orbit is actually the perfect example of this objectlessness, because although what you perceive to be something on the order of a square, in reality is a particle that is tracing the electric field, in this particular case, because the field is at a frequency of 50 hertz, so it's 50 times per second moving in this shape. And indeed, it, as Richard Feynman put it, there is much more room at the bottom. When you start going towards the bottom without even reaching the bottom or any kind of even horizon indicating any sort of bottom, already at this scale, which is actually quite macroscopic, but certainly very tiny for an artwork. So these are actually hollow glass microspheres. They are 180 microns in diameter, but they are strikingly visible as soon as you tune your vision to these small quadrants of space. And as you enter this this microscopic domain, you see interactions of energy and matter, of light, that wash away your notions of something actually being in one place at one time.
Before we open the floor to questions, and we're very much interested to to have a conversation all together with you. I just want to say a few words about the performance we will do later. It is called Mucilaginous Omniverse, and it's sonicated bath of silicone oil that makes little droplets of silicone bounce and not coalesce with the rest of silicone. So it's a kind of acoustic levitation or acoustic bouncing, depending on the sound signal you send through the silicone oil below it. And when we found out about this phenomenon about 10 years ago from a scientific paper, we just thought it was so gorgeous and so beautiful that we make an artwork with it. And the frequencies that cause this, they are in the audible, in the lower range of audible spectrum, so from 25 to 100 hertz, so you can very well hear the sounds that create this phenomenon. So we did this artwork, and a few years later, we encountered an article by a French scientist, Yves Coudert, who sadly passed away last year, but we were lucky enough to meet him in person and visit his lab in Paris at the Sorbonne University. So he performed a few very famous quantum experiments, such as double slit experiment, and what was else? The
quantized orbits
path memory.
The path memory were among the last experiments.
So he observed the same qualities that are observed for quantum entities for these little droplets, making this system one of the largest macroscopic analogs of quantum behavior. So it is not a quantum system, but some of its behavior are uncannily similar to some of the quantum systems. And Dmitry and I, we work a lot with fluids, and fluid dynamics and behavior of fluids is quite fascinating because there is no good mathematical description of the complexity of turbulence and of some of the complexity of such behaviors. At the same time, with certain fluid phenomena, you can find scientifically legitimate analogs of black holes, subatomic systems. So, for example, the Bohr-Wheeler model of the atomic nucleus is called the liquid model because the nucleus, the droplet, the nucleus behaves like a droplet of liquid. So all this very interstitious situations of this objectlessness, wave phenomena, fluid phenomena, this what fascinates us as a kind of cosmic language that we just can very simply, you know, just having a speaker, you can, it's not a very complex scientific experiment. So I don't know if Tamasa, you want to add anything?
Oh yes, I would like to add the following, that, you know, all of this is very different from a lot or maybe all of what we are used to, not only in, you know, classical and modern art, but even in contemporary art. And, you know, when you hear about it, it seems challenging, you know. I remember last year it was, I was invited at a workshop of Google about quantum computing, and they wanted to have some art, okay? And I described what Evelyn and Dmitry are doing, and so they were invited, but they had the performance at in the evening, and they wanted to give a talk, okay, about explaining a little bit to those scientists. And the organizers said, oh, no, we have no time. Here we are here to do some serious science. And so they gave their performance. And then the day after, the Google organizers, they had to change the schedule because there were 200 geeks who went up to the organizers and said, oh, we want to hear a talk about this. And why is that? For me, the key of this is in a word that which Evelina used and they often use, which is at the core both of art and science. She said that these things are beautiful. And if you think of it, I mean, there have been several thousands of years of debate what beautiful means. But when you see these things, they are immediately, obviously, clearly beautiful. So all the difficulty or complexity of the underlying phenomena disappear. And what they do is unravel the beauty of them for us. And it is very evident that this beauty here is not narrative, is not objective, but it is clearly immediately recognizable as something beautiful. I mean, is a sunset beautiful? A sunset, after all, is an objectless manifestation of some light refraction. And so, in a way, what they do with this is goes much beyond to what the typical scientist expects from an art-science collaboration, you know? We started this by thinking, oh, well, it's great. They do some analogous quantum mechanics. This will help us in some outreach. It will help us communicate our important stuff, you know? And then it is just the contrary. So what they show, what they put under our eyes is, you know, the beauty, so and the fact that what we do is meaningful because it is beautiful and not vice versa. And they make present to us that probably most of the beauty that is around us, the beauty of nature, this is really the beauty of nature in its purest form, and this is really something which, you know, through the eyes with which you observe their works, you come to realize that the beauty that you are used to take for granted has actually a much deeper meaning than what you are used to think about. That, you know, thinking of beautiful things in terms of objects is just one sort of trivial habit that we have, and that there is much, much more at the bottom, as Feynman said.
So, what time is it? Yes, we'd like to hear what you think about it. And if you have any questions to Tommaso, he's trying to build quantum computers in Europe. So you're putting some competition to Google. But so, in case you want to know what quantum computers are and if they really exist, he knows all the questions, the answers.
They're here for questions.
Okay.
Hey. How close to building a quantum computer are you? Because lots of people say that it's like still years away because it's technologically so difficult.
Would you like to ask your question as well? So
just wait.
Okay.
So it depends what you mean by you. So if you mean you, myself, well, it's about 150 meters. Because in the building across from my office in the research center in Zurich, which is Germany's largest national lab, at Christmas, we started having the first European small quantum computer with the superconducting qubits. We have a few qubits, so Google has 50. Now our schedule is by the end of this year to get to 20, so we have to catch up a little bit with this technology. If you ask you in terms of the European flagship, so our European initiative and the European scientific community, well, then I can say that the world's most powerful ion trap quantum computer, which is built by the people who built the devices we saw before in the same lab in which His Holiness was coming, he was there to see one single atom. And now our colleagues there in the group of Rainer Blatt in Innsbruck, now they are up to several dozens of atoms or ions, charged atoms, which are, you know, loaded in these traps. And they already performed several hundred logical operations, so big quantum circuits, and this is the world record at the moment with that particular technology. Also in Europe we have the world record for doing a quantum simulator, you know, putting atoms in a structure which is, you know, similar, analog, simulating, for instance, molecules or materials, where also we have atoms around in a molecule, but then in a quantum simulator you can put actual atoms in a controlled way and they reproduce the behavior of some substance. And also here in Europe we are very much ahead. And then if you ask you in terms of humanity, like, you know, all scientists in this field, then we can say that yes, Google has this 53 qubits quantum computer, which for the first time achieved some fantastic achievement. So in 3 minutes it solved a problem which the largest supercomputer on Earth would take 10,000 years to solve. And the largest supercomputer is a 14 megawatts thing, and the Google quantum computer is a 26 kilowatt thing, so you can have it at home. Unfortunately, the problem it solved is a completely, utterly, majestically useless problem. It is a problem which has been conceived only with the purpose of showing that the quantum computer can do it better than a supercomputer, but it is really a major milestone. And then you may say, can you buy it? Yes, IBM can sell you a quantum computer. They just sold one to Chancellor Merkel. She was in Davos. She had a drink with the CEO. This is not a legend, it really happened. She had a drink with the CEO of IBM. And the CEO said, would you like to buy a quantum computer? And Chancellor Merkel said, yes, why not? And so now IBM is selling it. It is 40 million euros for 20 qubits, 2 million per qubit. In Europe, we do things which are much cheaper, but the IBM one should admit, has a very nice case which was manufactured in Milan. Yeah. So probably this has also some aesthetic quality, which I cannot perceive, you know, evidently. Maybe it is objectless. So yes, there is a lot of progress. There are such machines. You can buy one.
Alessandro?
Yeah, from a strictly speaking computing nature, so I mean how information is computed, what do you think is the most important breakthrough that quantum computing conceptually brings with its own mechanism? And then I wanted, if possible, to ask Dimitri and Evelina, I'm particularly fascinated by this liquid approach and how it feeds specifically into the quantum mechanism, in your opinion.
So I can actually answer with something which is a liquid metaphor, which might help. So the main breakthrough is when you have a computer, you do a calculation, you have an input, you have an output, and in the middle you have some steps. Now you want to do the same calculation with a different input to get a different output, well, you start over again, and you do the same steps, again in sequence. And a quantum computer, the main thing it can do is it can go in parallel through all possibilities. And there is a way to visualize that, which is a liquid metaphor, you know. If you have a labyrinth and you are at the entrance, you are on one side and you want to get out on the other side, well, you have to try all possible paths, one after the other. But with a quantum computer, you could try them all at the same time, which is like, you know, pouring a lot of water inside it and seeing where it comes from and then inferring what was the path. And this is a metaphor which is to some extent accurate. Of course, we are not throwing water at our quantum computer, but it is to some extent accurate because there is a fluid which is an abstract fluid, which is a probability, so-called probability amplitude. It is a wave made of probability, which, you know, goes around. And this is this wave which makes it possible that you have the atom here and there at the same time. You know, this is a probability wave with different probabilities for different possibilities. And then at the end, you come to the result. So this wave function, this wave nature, this, if you could, you could say liquid nature of quantum objects, is really what enables the parallelism, which gives you this enormous computing power for some specific problems.
So for your question, you will see it in the performance, but I just want you to pay attention. So the maybe even after we finish the performance, we can keep our speaker running, so you are also welcome to come and see the scale with your own eyes, because we also, the reason we don't do recordings and don't show video of our work, because we believe that the direct observation and understanding the scale and the time scale really helps you to tune in. So the droplets that you will see, they are from 5 millimeter in diameter to 1 millimeter and submillimeter, and the smaller they are, the closer they are to quantum objects. So the bigger, heavier one, they behave more classically, but also in a very weird way. But the small ones that will be like going very fast, they are really the quantum analogs.
So I guess I was going to go into another quantum analog, but since indeed you're going to be watching this performance in a few minutes, we will return to mucilaginous omniverse. If you imagine that the droplet in this case, that this droplet is, it's essentially being upward, so there's a bath of silicon oil. Underneath this bath is a vibrating membrane. It acoustically regenerates a buffer of air between droplets that are being released and the bath itself, hence preventing these droplets from immediately merging with the rest of the bath. So in this state, the droplet, besides hovering, it's indeed bouncing, as Evelina mentioned, and this bouncing motion on this buffer of air, on this kind of air-oil interface, creates a capillary wave. And these capillary waves, they interlock with the waves of their neighbors. And you will be able to see that so once again, if you imagine that the droplet is our analog of a particle, then this droplet will always have its own wave double. You can see it fairly well in this image here, how every droplet has kind of a halo around it. That is this capillary wave that it creates. And so this interlocking is indeed not, it is not as though the droplet is getting entangled with its neighbor. It is actually the wave of this droplet, this capillary wave, that does so. And as a result, it manifests itself in these geometric lattice formations, as well as various orbital structures. And these orbits are also quantized in the sense that depending upon the frequency of the sound and the amplitude of the sound, we can change this spinning motion. And it's a spinning motion that is interlocked with the once again, the wave nature of these capillary wave fields. So, there are many domains in fluid dynamics where not only does it help us to understand the quantum realms that are, of course, confined to very tiny domains, but also just very briefly, a more recent artwork where we create a liquid analog. This was a collaboration with LIGO of two entangled black holes. So here there's another kind of interlocking that we have, and it's also a staging of the double slit experiment, which was actually the first quantum experiment way before quantum theory existed. That's right.
1800, performed with a candle and a piece of paper.
Yes, that back in those days, of course, there was a big debate going on as to whether light came in corpuscles or particles, as Newton proclaimed, or if it had a wave nature, as Thomas Young proclaimed, who conducted this double slit experiment. So here, these black hole analogs are formed when a chamber of water is displaced, going through a slit, and as soon as this volume of water goes through the slit, it forms this vortex pair. I guess I could show a little video of it, but perhaps we'll send the microphone back into the audience and there. Yes.
I actually have a question that I hope isn't contentious. I don't mean it to be. It's around the politics between Google and the lab in Europe. Is there sharing of information? Is like within those that are actually working on this? Is there contention between groups working on it? I mean, presumably it's also that there must be people working on it in Asia as well. I mean, I guess I'm just wondering how what's the culture around it? And is there trepidation about sort of Google being ahead and Google being what Google is and all of that?
So, well,
the politics of quantum computing.
Yes. So, well, actually, last time I had a face-to-face meeting with Commissioner Gabriel, who was the European Commissioner for Digital and now is the European Commissioner for Research. She started by saying, "Oh, nice to meet you, but what about Google?" And then I explained, because we had a cooperation with our Forschungszentrum Jülich and Google on the purely scientific level, and there was a press release, okay, and when she saw the press release, she got quite nervous, and she asked her director general, "But what about Calarco?" And her director general said, "Oh, no, he, you see, he's not on the picture," and the only reason was that, you know, on that day I was somewhere in video conference. And the European Commission is very nervous. So after I explained, she said, "No, but can you explain about Google?" And then when we were taking the picture, you know, in front of the European flag, handshaking and so on, she said, "But be careful about Google." And the reason for that is that on the scientific side, actually, we don't have any contract in which we sell the result of our work to Google. We are not bound by confidentiality. There are other institutions in Europe which do this with other US companies, yeah? And IBM is imposing some of these clauses on their work, and also Intel and so on. But the cooperation we have with Google is just scientific, and you know, we exchange ideas. So on the scientific side, I would say even with any country you name, with you know, the US, Canada, Japan, Australia, also Russia, China, there are a lot of very good cooperations, because you know, with colleagues, you know, really science has no borders, like beauty. But when it comes to making these devices, that's why, this is the anecdote I told, that's why our governments get nervous, and with reasons that I can understand, I would say with good reasons, because the ideas that we develop, well, it would be desirable that they also bring to wealth creation here, where they have been developed, you know? We are here in a particle physics context, if you wish. The World Wide Web was invented at CERN, and none of the revenue it created is on this continent. So the European Commission and other governments would like to change this. Okay, and of course, it's not by chance that Google has the money to throw at this undertaking, which is wonderful because it progresses science. It is really mankind against nature. It's not one country against the other. It's not one company against the other. In essence, it's enormous challenges. So it's great that Google has these resources. At the same time, why do they have so many resources? Well, obviously, because the profit from the Internet Revolution is sitting in the US, not in Europe. This is what we would like to change with the next wave of technology. And this includes also the fact that this is a technology which can have, an important strategic dimension for development of industry. A lot of the pharma industry, the car industry, is interested in quantum computing. BMW, Daimler, they have groups of tens of people working on this because they want to be able to exploit this revolution. But now, if we would only buy machines from IBM, say, one could say, you can buy it from IBM, and then you use it, you develop software. But then, if Mr. Trump one day decides, I put export control on this. This is strategic for my country. You're not going to have it anymore. This is a big problem. So this is where, the reason why our politicians, with good reason, they would like to stimulate progress as well as wealth creation also here in Europe. And this is not so much, I would say, of course, when you go to industry, there is a dimension of competition, but it's more a question of not being dependent, not being so reliant on some foreign technology that then you are dependent on that, and anything that happened over there can have a big impact on us. So it's about, creating, harmonious ecosystems everywhere, so that essentially all citizens of the world can profit from this, not, depending on what a certain despot decides.
Okay, thank you for a really nice presentation so far. So good. But it's really itching my feet. I have a really big problem with beauty in relation to art and science. So artists are not really giving the experience of beauty, the aesthetic experience to science. That's not the goal. The goal is knowledge. And art is knowledge. And this is an agenda that is political for us as well as for many European politicians, quantum computing today. We need to fight against this idea that is futile, is not fertile, and we cannot defend art as a tool for science, for making aesthetic experience, for engagement. And this is what we've been talking about for the last few years. So I'd like to know the opinion of Evelina and Dimitri. How do you respond to your work as a tool for science? Because I don't think your work is a tool for science.
So if you are uncomfortable with the word beauty, I can also say transcendence. So reaching this state of transcendence that sometimes you can, it could be the experience of extreme danger, sublime, or beauty, or rapture. But this is an experience of transcendence that we strive for. And that's why our definition of beauty, most of the people, when look at boiling water and looking at bubbles, they will not think it's beautiful. But for me, it's beautiful, and I can enter a state of transcendence observing it. So it's also, and this kind of knowledge, I can say knowledge is brainwashing. Everything you've been taught is a kind of cage. So I really work for the goal of people transcending their borders, for not so much for society, but for a single individual having this experience of transcendence. And I think our work is very political, my work with Dmitry, because it is not accepted that a person from the streets comes into a quantum physics lab and could be equal, and can work together. So this is my little tiny dimension of breaking these borders and doing very political work, because in the beginning we were laughed at. When scientists heard that we're not from an institution and we don't have education in physics, they just stopped conversation and turned their backs. But in 20 years, the things changed tremendously. So, yes, so of course, beauty is not what Hollywood tells us. Keep this in mind.
Well, I mean, we can certainly go on about the context of beauty from a purely philosophical, from a phenomenological perspective. And when I say phenomenology, I don't just mean the phenomenology in terms of its origins in philosophy of the beginning of the 20th century. I'm also talking about the kind of phenomenology that is practiced in physics today to create mathematical models for phenomena that have yet to be embraced by a theory. But the idea of a tool, I don't believe that neither art nor science are exactly tools. In fact, I really, really shy away from the applied sciences. And although the promise of quantum computing is something that enables a great deal of funding and energy to enter the domain of extremely obscure research, the true goal, although I don't believe that it's really a goal, it's something much bigger than that, because once again, a goal is also something that hints towards a tool. What is happening in these laboratories that are striving towards quantum simulation and quantum computation is really the most fundamental physics of all. Working with cold atoms, working with Bose-Einstein condensates, these are the limits of knowledge. And at those limits, there is no knowledge to speak of. It's just that. It's really the ineffable. When it's standing on a precipice. They're not working towards this application in earnest. They're working towards unraveling the bottom of reality.
Thanks, it's a great question. So shall we keep talking, or maybe we transcend to the performance? Yes. We'll do a little break and we'll put the seats here because the sound will be best here. So maybe we'll start in 10 minutes. Thank you very much.